Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Carla Pariser, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the March 13th issue. This issue is the music issue. The first article is entitled Growing Older, Adele and ABBA Sing Songs of Experience by Jeremy Gordon. Each of the British singer Adele's records is named after the age she was when she began writing it. It's a taxonomic habit that neatly summarizes her creative concerns. She was 19 when she sang about fixating on her nascent loves, 21 when she started moving on, 25 when she started looking back, and so it made intuitive sense when, on last year's 30, her widescreen balladeering veered away from youthful anguish into more explicitly adult territory. Claiming that an artist has recorded her most personal album yet is a decades-old marketing cliché. But 30 was actually and unavoidably personal, substantially shaped by Adele's split from her husband, Simon Konecki, with every track pulling directly from her experience as a newly divorced woman. Consider Easy on Me the album's first single. Unlike Adele's previous lead singles, the brawny fight song Rolling in the Deep, the show-stopping epic Hello, Easy on Me was smaller in scope. Over a subdued piano arrangement, Adele sang about seeking forgiveness during this tumultuous part of her life. Despite the emotional modesty, Easy on Me broke single-day streaming records upon its release, buoyed by fervent anticipation and the collective belief that Adele was about to communicate something important. The song ended up topping the Billboard Hot 100 for 10 weeks. There's a specific power that accrues when a singer, through the natural procession of time, manages to turn her long public story into something like gravitas. Frank Sinatra could have sung My Way as a fresh-faced crooner, but it was the older man, exhausted by the music industry's machinations, who made it a standard. Some artists even managed to age into their own back catalog. Adele herself previously scored a hit with When We Were Young, a glossy and dramatic ballad about longing for the old days in the twilight of your life. She released that when she was just 27. You can imagine the distant future where she'll sing it to graying millennials, nostalgic for this song about nostalgia. Making positive use of your maturity is inherently at odds with pop music's unyielding search for the newer, younger thing. And these fresh faces will, in turn, reward the industry's faith by singing about semi-universal concerns like going out and being sad in a cool way. But usually not something legitimately bracing, like the slow realization that they too cannot avoid aging. Many stars struggle to fold more sobering concerns into their work or even their personal lives. Michael Jackson spent most of his adulthood trying to return to a state of prelapsarian innocence. Britney Spears was legally barred from escaping the rarefied celebrity she built for herself as a teenager. Those are extreme cases. But even a fully realized artist like Madonna, who has chased modern pop trend after modern pop trend, seems allergic to the admittedly loaded concept of acting your age. Great singers, the Aretha Franklins, the Tina Turners, the Whitney Houstons, aren't immune to the pressures of the market or society. They too release bad records and engage in all sorts of confusing personal behavior. Yet it takes only one jaw-dropping vocal performance to remind us of their power. Often this appreciation dovetails with the way we've consumed their private turmoils, and we now hear their art as a transference of wisdom and experience. When they sing those big painful songs that seem to draw every inch of air out of their lungs, it's easy to believe that they understand the agony of living a little more than we do. Adele was a convincing singer from the beginning, but the tabloid-friendly turbulence of her personal life allows us to think she's really going through it. There's a deepening complexity in how she sings about adulthood on 30, about new loves, small disappointments, unexpected moments of confusion and shame, and all this while trying to raise a small child. Of course, it sounds more authentic than if she were imagining the emotions she might have one day. Last year, the Swedish radio giants ABBA released Voyage, their first new album in 40 years. Voyage sounded foremost like an ABBA record. Bouncy grooves, melancholic orchestration, the twin dusky voices of Agnetha Flaktag and Annifrid Lindstag, which was reason enough to celebrate. But it also sounded like music made by a band now in their 70s, completing a thematic loop with earlier songs like The Winner Takes It All, which drew freely from their own adult lives. The songs reference self-doubt in the face of age, the pining for lovers long gone who never returned, the potential of revived love at the end of life. Voyage was recorded with ABBA's old backing band, or most of it anyway, and written by Björn Ulvaeus and Benny Andersson, just like all their previous albums. Unlike some contemporary records made by aging pop stars, there were no collaborations with buzzy songwriters, no guest appearances by much younger singers. The resistance to modernity didn't necessarily make for better music by itself, but ABBA's approach felt like an honest acknowledgement of how the band had experienced the last 40 years. They had broken up and never really considered the possibility of making more music. And then, suddenly, the stars aligned for one more record, on which they could sing about their understanding of life as an older, wiser unit. It's rare to watch popular performers grow older through their creative work, singing material that reflects who they are in their advancing years, in front of an audience willing to pay attention. When they do, something wonderful can happen. Songs make us feel things, and pop songs are pointed at the largest possible audience. And so sometimes many of us can sit together, in spirit, if not in body, listening to Adele, or ABBA, or whomever else singing about who they are now, thinking about how we've changed as well. The industry will probably always prioritize something hotter and younger, but in those moments we can glimpse evidence, up there in the cultural firmament, that always purports to reflect our hopes and fears of how life goes on, and so we might believe it goes on for us too. The next article is entitled Difficult Conversations. Eventually, we all talk about Bruno by Sam Anderson. We all know deep in the marrow of our animated American bones what a Disney mega hit sounds like. It is slow and rising and inspirational, a bubble designed to lift us up octave by octave to a better place. It's all about altitude. High notes and high emotions are belted out at high volume, often by characters who rise, literally, high above their surroundings. Elsa the Ice Princess sings Let It Go while climbing to the tippy top of the tallest peak in the vast winter landscape. Aladdin and Princess Jasmine harmonize a whole new world at cruising altitude on a magic carpet, whipping past minarets. Disney's signature ballads tend to be anthems of individual elevation, heroes transcending society. As Elsa puts it, no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. Well, not the newest Disney mega hit, We Don't Talk About Bruno. The breakout song from the animated film Encanto is the company's biggest musical success since the old juggernauts of the 1990s. And yet Bruno sounds nothing like A Whole New World, or Can You Feel the Love Tonight, or Colors of the Wind. It is not an uplifting aria or a yearning lament. Bruno is tense and busy, a crowded, convulsing, percussive, down-in-the-weeds medley sung in shifts by society itself. Instead of elevating us above the crowd, Bruno drops us right down into the anxious fray. It is the opposite of escapism. So why is it such a hit? Encanto tells the story of the enchanted madrigals, an ordinary human family blessed with magical powers. They live in utopian harmony, employing their gifts, super hearing, super strength, etc., to help nearby villagers until their perfect world starts to crack. Because it's Disney, literal cracks rip across the house and landscape. In the resulting chaos, everyone begins to fixate on a forbidden subject. Bruno, the family outcast. Bruno's power was prophecy. He was a truth teller, but people didn't want to hear the truth, so he disappeared. For years, he has been only an absence, a taboo, a raw nerve at the center of their world. Right from its title, We Don't Talk About Bruno is self-contradictory. Immediately and obsessively, it does the thing it says it's not doing. One by one, major and minor characters do talk about Bruno, listing his various prophecies and purported crimes. He sees your dreams and feasts on your screams, in a conspiratorial tone. These voices pile up and overlap until the song becomes a huge ensemble showstopper, a la One Day More in Les Miserables. You'd need a crowd to sing it at karaoke. By the end, everybody is talking simultaneously about what supposedly nobody is talking about. Lay it out like that, and you can see why Bruno is popular in 2022 America. It echoes an anxiety that dominates our society, the fraught rules of public discourse. Who is allowed to talk about what? What can we say in public, in private, in seriousness, in jest? Who gets to decide? These anxieties tend to burst out in a variety of flashpoints and buzzwords and panics. Cancel culture, critical race theory, the woke mob. But it all reflects the same obsession. In a nation that prides itself on free speech, we devote approximately 90% of our speech to adjudicating the rules of our speech. We talk ceaselessly about our talking. In the 1990s, the classic Disney fantasy of individual escapism might still just barely have made sense. But here, in our agitated new century, it's hard to imagine a single voice rising above the fray. Climb to the peak of a mountain, singing at the top of your lungs, and you'll most likely find a crowd already there arguing. We can, at most, hope to be one small voice in the chorus, doing our best not to be drowned out, discussing the discussion of the discussion. And We Don't Talk About Bruno is our great, noisy, troubled anthem. The next article is entitled Running Scams. Meet Music's New Outlaw Hero, The Online Scammer, by Jody Rosen. Pop music has always had a pedagogical streak. For decades, hit records have offered instruction and edification, lessons from the Book of Love, step-by-step guides to dance crazes. But few songs provide as detailed a tutorial as How to Write a Dump, a recent single by the rapper Punchmade Dev. Go and get a Fire Carter site. Go to the dump section, he counsels. You better put a proxy server on or use public connection. Some rappers aim insults at competitors' weak rhymes or played-out styles. Dev reserves his scorn for IT blunders. No, dumbass, you don't need EMV software. That's only if you're trying to code the chip they put on there. You just need a MSR plus the Defton software. Punchmade Dev from Lexington, Kentucky, delivers these lines over a rudimentary beat in a breathless rasp, the voice of a man who is trying to convey crucial information as quickly as possible. How to Write a Dump is just over a minute and a half long. What he is outlining, after all, is a caper. A dump is a kind of internet crime in which fraudsters access stolen credit card information to create clone cards. Dev's nom de guerre refers to punches, slang both for entering the credit card numbers onto new cards and for making illegal purchases. Other songs have titles that mince no words: Stolen Credit Cards, Internet Swiping, In Scams We Trust. Dev is a scam rapper, part of a vanguard of underground MCs who have begun creeping toward rap's center stage. Hip-hop is always quick to pick up on cultural currents, including trends in not-quite-legal enterprises. In recent years, some star rappers have been shouting out the scammers and making references to online fraud. But for MCs like Dev, scamming is a stock in trade, a muse, a worldview. Scam rap is music by and of digital natives, a generation that has come of age on an internet swarming with dissemblers and con artists, social media grifters, phishing scheme spammers, Tinder swindlers, cryptocurrency shills, conspiracy theorists, troll farm armies that spread disinformation. In 2022, scam rap is still a niche phenomenon, but it feels more trenchant, more tuned in to the anxious state of the world and the forces shaping culture and politics than the big hits that dominate charts and streaming playlists. It's a sign, a sound of the times. It's also a product of a place. The center of American scam rap is Detroit, a city that has birthed many musical future shocks. Around 2017, a handful of rappers there began mixing the familiar sounds and stories of trap music, brawny, brass-heavy beats, and narratives about the drug trade, with lyrics referencing ill-gotten online gains. A couple of years later, another young Detroiter, TJX6, emerged as the genre's breakout star. He took a novel approach, focusing monomaniacally on scamming in songs packed with hacker lingo and the technical nitty-gritty of dark web swindles. TJX6 is funny. Just got a Fire profile and logged into Credit Karma. Can't even get my hair cut no more because I done scammed my barber, he raps in Apple 2019. He has storytelling skills, a flair for action-adventure scenes in unlikely settings. The viral hit Swipe Story, in which he uses a dummy credit card to load up on electronics and gift cards, generates suspense from a Walmart shopping spree. The song has little in the way of a hook, and the verses pour out in a chatty, unmetrical stream, a flow that owes as much to YouTube instructional videos as to rap itself. Many of TJX6's songs, like Punch May Devs, take the form of how-to manuals that purport to give foolproof advice. You can get the process done perfectly if you listen closely. This is an in-store Best Buy pickup method. Listen to these steps. It's unclear how reliable the songs are as guides to committing fraud, but they reflect real aspirations and articles of faith. The belief that systems and power structures, especially financial ones, can be subverted by anyone sufficiently gutsy and schooled in the dark arts. The music of TJX6 and fellow Detroit scam rappers, songs like Kasher Kwan, CNN News, and band gang Havar's Only Scams, have a distinctive Rust Belt flavor. The lyrics bristle with local slang, and the music videos are bathed in the noir glow of Motor City backstreets and strip malls. But historically speaking, these rappers are latecomers to scamming music, which first gained prominence years ago, thousands of miles away. The closest thing to a scam rap your text dates back more than a decade and a half, and it isn't rap at all. I Go Chop Your Dollar was a song from The Master, a 2005 Nigerian comedy film about a fraudster who specializes in the Nigerian Prince, or 419 scam, named for a section of the Nigerian Penal Code, the infamous email swindle that entices the gullible to wire transfer money in exchange for promised riches. The song is performed by the movie's star, the comedian Nkem Owa, as a party anthem, propelled by dance rhythms and triumphal brass blasts. 419 is just a game, Owa sings. You are the loser, I am the winner. This article does continue, but we'll stop here so we have time for a few more articles from this week's issue. The next article is entitled Hating Fame. Plenty of musicians have moaned about their celebrity. Lorde and her peers are recalibrating their approach, by Larry Fitzmaurice. In rock, being famous is often treated as a self-inflicted wound. What you get is no tomorrow. What you need, you have to borrow. David Bowie sneered on his 1975 single, Fame. Years later, on Smells Like Teen Spirit, Nirvana's Kurt Cobain, an artist who practically drafted the modern blueprint for despising your own success, bemoaned what his prodigiousness had wrought. I'm worse at what I do best, and for this gift I feel blessed. Hip-hop might seem more comfortable flaunting stardom and status, but doing so is no less burdensome for its practitioners. Observe the gold-plated tears shed by Drake or Kanye West in any of their attention-grabbing invectives against attention, or DJ Khaled's 2013 album, Suffering from Success, featuring his pained visage on a cover offset by blindingly bright drip. The revelations unearthed during the recent dissolution of Britney Spears' conservatorship were just more proof that blowing up can leave lasting damage. The battlefield of the top of the pop charts is littered with superstars audibly struggling to survive the perils of fame. But thanks to the hyperconnectivity of the digital age, you don't even have to be massively famous to become wary of the attention economy. Even the indie rocker Mac DeMarco questions it on his song, passing out pieces of me. Don't you know nothing comes free? Is it any wonder, then, that several pop stars have expressed a desire in the last year to retreat from the spotlight, to imagine what their music and their life would have been if they had never found success at all? Things I once enjoyed just keep me employed now, sighs 20-year-old Billie Eilish, who has enjoyed more industry success in the last 2 years than mostly in an entire career on Getting Older. It's the opening track on her ironically titled second album, Happier Than Ever, an excellent record that sounds like a slow, quiet backing away from anything resembling popularity. And after a decade of being a lightning rod for public scrutiny, Lana Del Rey closed last year's Chemtrails Over the Country Club with a cover of Joni Mitchell's For Free, a song about the joys of creation when no one's paying attention, and one that, in Del Rey's context, doubles as a reference to her own thorny relationship with public life. But few have captured this camera-shy moment as clearly as Lorde. The New Zealand pop phenomenon returned after a long absence with Solar Power, released in August, befuddling fans and critics with a seemingly lackadaisical new mode of creation. Tonally, it could not be more different from the hair-raising intimacy of her previous album, Melodrama, 2017. Lorde has referred to Solar Power as a weed album, and as an artistic statement, it recalls another cannabis-conjured record, if not in sound, then in form, Neil Young's 1974 bummer masterpiece, On the Beach, which he recorded while consuming sticky, sweet, homemade edibles known as honey slides. Young was 28 when On the Beach was released. Lorde is 25. Each record captures an artist in the afterglow of unprecedented success, pondering their place in the world and worrying that the paths they have chosen lead to nothing but regret. Young with his big folk rock creations and Lorde with her slight Spartan pop songs. Solar Power orbits around the acoustic glow of Stoned at the Nail Salon, a single that doubles as the album's mission statement. True to its title, the song mimics the feeling of being high in a setting, warm, sun-kissed, with currents of uncertainty and sadness cresting its blissed-out surface. Got a wishbone drying on the windowsill in my kitchen. Lorde sings over gentle guitar, acknowledging her good fortune, before wondering whether she actually rolled snake eyes instead, just in case I wake up and realize I've chosen wrong. Lorde's music also carries a wry sense of humor. The joke of Stoned at the Nail Salon is all in the title. At the end of every verse, she undercuts her own despairing ruminations with the chorus, "Maybe I'm just stoned at the nail salon again." But as she's joined by Phoebe Bridgers and Claro, two ascendant stars on similar paths of cultishly beloved stardom, the song feels heavier. I'd ride and I'd ride on the carousel, round and round, forever if I could, the three sing together, but it's time to cool it down, whatever that means. These sentiments, uncertainty, melancholy, a willingness to vanish from the limelight, are delivered with a sense of calm self-possession that breaks with Lorde's iconoclastic predecessors, who push back against fame's trappings as loudly as they could. There's no rending of flesh here. To Lorde and her generational cohort, raging against the machine is pointless, possibly carcinogenic, and perhaps a bit passé. Better to just walk away from it all, or at least sing a song about wanting to. The next article is entitled Meeting the Parent. Taylor Swift and Tyler, the Creator, Excavate Old Relationships by Laura Snapes. One way to define the arrival of adulthood might be when introducing a new partner to your parents is no longer cause for embarrassment. Maybe they get along. Maybe you get the approval you secretly crave. And maybe you don't. But if your parents are worthy of the faith you've placed in them, they'll let you make your own mistakes. In two of Pop's newest, most comprehensive accounts of heartbreak, this is the moment that might outstrip all the other agonies. The shame of introducing a lover to a parent whose welcoming smile almost certainly conceals a bitten tongue. One is Taylor Swift's All Too Well, a fan favorite from her 2012 album Red, that she has newly re-released, now 10 minutes long, with the inclusion of its long, mythologized, lost verses. In one of them, Swift's new older boyfriend charms her father with self-effacing jokes, sipping coffee like you were on a late-night show. But the perfect suitor charade soon falters. Just one line later, the father sits with his anxious daughter as she watches the door for her boyfriend's arrival on a pivotal birthday, and he remarks, with exquisite tact, "It's supposed to be fun, turning 21. Mr. Swift could compare notes with the mother of Tyler, the creator. On Wilshire, the highlight of Tyler's 2021 album, Call Me If You Get Lost, the rapper brings a love interest to his mother's tennis spot, despite being well aware that his crush already has a boyfriend. He knows this because, worse still, Tyler is friends with the guy. He's racked with despair over his loyalties. They say bros over hoes. I'm like, nah, hey, I would rather hold your hand than have a cool handshake," he admits furtively. Even at the outset of this song, which runs nearly 9 minutes, we know he'll be left empty-handed. All Too Well and Wilshire both reflect something agonizingly specific about young heartbreak. As protagonists, Swift and Taylor are old enough to try out parts of adult relationships, romantic getaways, intimate private jokes, but their naive faith in their relationships obscures the germinating seeds of failure. These are unusually purgative songs, speaking to their author's abiding confusion at how the path to romance can dogleg so brutally. Their heft recalls the moment when a friend switches from text to unwieldy voice notes, the scope of their dilemma beyond what a blue iMessage bubble can contain. Online, it's usually brevity that begets pop success. But here, the relentless confession is the appeal. These perplexed epics demand to be told in their full complexity, every glance and item of clothing and sparkling scene, another crucial scrap of proof that the author didn't imagine this. Yet no amount of compulsive litigation can explain how your soulmate wound up such an inscrutable mystery. Both songs obsessively scour for motive. The restored verses of All Too Well add a level of anger as Swift accuses her heartbreaker of insincerity, coldness, and having a conspicuous thing for younger women. Swift is now 32, and the song's new power comes from her understanding that she deserved better than she ever knew to expect at 21. That perspective shift is only underlined by the reason we're hearing this expanded version at all. In 2019, Swift's former label and the 6 albums she made there were sold to a music executive she described as a bully, prompting her to re-record them in an effort to reclaim ownership of her work and devalue his investment. These lost verses might be another reclamation, reinstating emotions once deemed unbecoming for a young woman. Tyler's situation is murkier. He and the woman both know they're walking a moral high wire. They delete even innocent texts and arouse her boyfriend's suspicion with their cagey ha-ha-has. Tyler feels guilty, then reckless. His newfound acquaintance with true desire makes a mockery of the gilded lifestyle he extols elsewhere on the album. No amount of French vanilla ice cream eaten barefoot on a yacht could compare. He knows the woman wants him, but it transpires not enough to actually leave her boyfriend. Tyler resents the guy, hates himself, and even briefly hates her, until he admits he's incapable of that and moves beyond blame. Some feelings defy morality, the 30-year-old concludes, not to mention maturity. It made me realize adults don't know what they're doing either. Swift, meanwhile, remembers the first fall of snow and how it glistened as it fell in her relationship's early days, still convinced by the magic that got her into this mess. In 1956, a 13-year-old Frankie Lyman contemplated the inevitability of heartbreak on Why Do Fools Fall in Love? For him, it's a simple equation. 66 years later, Swift and Tyler pile on the evidence to insist they weren't fools and prove Lyman's point exactly. The next article is entitled Burning Out. Jorge Smith, Thames, and Now Reminds Us of Freedom in Doing Nothing by Jackson Howard. Burn, a highlight from the British singer Jorge Smith's 2021 EP Be Right Back, functions as both a therapy session and a cautionary tale. Smith, her voice soaked in empathy and disappointment, hovers over a melancholy bossa nova shuffle, addressing a young woman on the brink. You keep it all in, but you don't let it out, she tells her, pained. You try so hard, don't you know you've burnt out? Smith, who shot to stardom in 2017 after two attention-grabbing appearances on Drake's mixtape More Life, followed by a sensational debut album, Lost and Found, is only 24. She is perceptive beyond her years, equipped with a voice that, at its full power, could stop traffic. On Burn, though, she sounds as defeated as her protagonist, subdued and delicate. It's not an empowerment anthem, but then, almost at a whisper, Smith pivots toward something like reassurance. The fire is always there, she reminds her subject, but also her listener and maybe herself. No one needs to get hurt. Before the onset of the pandemic, burnout was something we were encouraged to actively combat. Countless articles and books were published on how to fight it. I felt, even at my most exhausted, that I had to find a way to push back, that I was stuck in a cycle, not only of burnout, but of incessant attempts to fix it. During the pandemic, though, I started noticing something new. I struggled all the time to get small tasks done, but the stakes suddenly evaporated, as did my resistance. Slack pinged. I just stared. My boyfriend at the time wanted to nap with me in the middle of the day. I jumped into bed. Time slowed and then leapt ahead, glitching. I couldn't for the life of me find the urgency in anything. In 2021, three singers, Smith, her countrywoman Now, and the Nigerian singer Thames, captured this sense of endemic, all-encompassing burnout. Their exhaustion came not from the drudgery of commuting to and from a desk job, but from the inherent slog of living in a body in 2021, a grinding and disappointing year. Instead of responding with the saccharine inspirational maxims or rote cynicism, they chose to soak in their fatigue. Their music felt appropriate to the moment when our collective enervation became something to live with and to submit to, a weariness we could no longer outrun. Maybe just go slow. There's nothing to run for now, sings on the Celestial Burnout, a track from her third studio album. And then life was beautiful, 'cause we ain't rushing no more. We got what we came for. It's emblematic of how many of us dealt with the past couple of years. We reassessed the problems that, pre-pandemic, felt life or death, but now seem trivial. Why rush, she asks, when there's nowhere to be? Thames, whose yearning chorus on WizKid's summer hit Essence instantly made her a rising star, doubles down on inaction in the face of pressure. If I continue, my ice might break, she sings on the hallucinatory and sensual Vibe Out from her outstanding second EP. If Orange was a place, her solution. I'm Vibe Out today, away, she repeats on the chorus like a mantra, her otherwise viscous voice reduced to a thin mumble. She would rather walk away than break down. Upon hearing Smith's Burn for the first time, I was immediately comforted not only by her recognition of everything I'd been feeling, but also by the permission I felt she was granting me to simply stop. Hearing Smith tell me that nothing was lost by slowing down felt like a revelation, a salve of sorts. Just stop stressing. Before COVID, the pressure to constantly optimize myself consumed me. But in the wake of millions of deaths and the restructuring of daily existence, fixing myself no longer feels like a goal. You can call it burnout or just the acceptance of my own limitations. Self-compassion has slowly come to replace the guilt I used to feel when I fell short. There is a freedom in doing nothing. All three of these singers remind us. The fire is always there, and no one needs to get hurt. The next article is entitled Mixed Emotions, The Delicious Misery of the Sad Banger by Hanif Abdurraq. I have spent a lot of time these last 2 years managing small collisions of feeling, sadness laid over pleasure, heartbreak laid over some unnamed desire. This was a result of prolonged pandemic living and all the little rituals we've devised to get through it. The Zoom birthday parties, wedding receptions, dance get-togethers, trivia nights. I enjoyed the idea of these events, but the thought of attending them filled me with a cocktail of longing and dread, despite the immense pleasure I felt in seeing the faces of people I loved. The minute-by-minute emotional contradictions of this era have been fascinating to watch unfold, and I've been searching for music capacious enough to hold them all. My pandemic soundtracks came to revolve around what I call sad bangers. More plainly put, songs whose lyrics of grief, anxiety, yearning, or some other mild or great darkness are washed over with an upbeat tune, or a chorus so infectious that it can weave its way into your brain, without your brain taking stock of whatever emotional damage it carries with it. Some of these songs were decades old, some of them brand new, but all of them speak to the frequent misalignment between what the body wants and the mind understands. We are all suffering from a prolonged hunger, and the realities of our circumstances won't let us be satiated. Sad bangers aren't a new phenomenon, but the old ones have a new potency, like Bruce Springsteen's Hungry Heart, a song I found myself returning to early and often in my pandemic playlists. The instrumental intro is danceable and upbeat, but then the first line pulls a curtain back on another reality. Our narrator has a wife and kids he has left, hitting the road and not looking back. The trick of the sonic and lyrical imbalances here is that if you get too swept up in one, you might be able to shove the other to the back of your mind. If even for a moment, getting pulled in by the song's storyline might deny you the pleasure of its call to the dance floor, and being too caught up in the demand to dance might render the narrative pointless. This captures exactly what I love most about the sad banger, that it gets beyond binary emotions and unlocks a multi-layered fullness that might, depending on the song, involve dancing and crying and longing and stumbling out of some dive bar mid-tune to text or call the person you probably shouldn't. You can measure the success of a song by the limitlessness of emotions and impulses it can seduce out of a person. Robin's Dancing on My Own may be the ultimate sad banger, and it is undoubtedly a classic within the canon, taking its emotional and sonic cues from a long line of sad disco anthems and new wave hits. Robin herself has cited musicians like Donna Summer and Sylvester, and songs like Dancing with Tears in My Eyes by Ultravox. All these artists dabble in bright electronic up-tempo odes to the specifics of heartbreak, performed with a sort of suddenness and urgency, as if a person has just walked from the ruins of emotional wreckage and needs to deliver a report on the damage while the memory of it is still fresh. The sad banger has a lineage that begins sometime around the moment a person realized that a sad song didn't have to feel sad, though it is also an art to summon that kind of feeling. The pleading of Otis Redding, or the way Dusty Springfield could sound in awe of her own sadness, as if it were arriving to her for the first time, a shining jewel in the center of an open box. But I recall a lesson I learned once from a poetry mentor. Sadness, like many of the big surface emotions, can be primary color, bold and obvious, still waiting to be mixed with others to create the specific hue you want to use. Not always, of course. There are times when I am simply sad, and there is no emotional accompaniment. But other times, the sadness is one smattering on a canvas that is asking for something else. I'm sad, but I still want. I'm sad because I'm jealous, and that jealousy is unlocking a passion or a pleasure. I'm sad because of what I can't control, which pulls me with arms open toward things I can control. The magic in this type of song is that it doesn't ask you to lay your burdens down. Bring the burdens with you if you can carry them. You don't have to part with your precious sadness in order to enter the portal of a song that might also entice you to dance or throw your head back in ecstasy. The singers who are the best architects of these songs, like Carly Rae Jepsen, who pretty much earned a PhD in the sad banger on her album Emotion, are vocally convincing and sometimes comforting. They know you're wading through difficult emotional waters, and they are present, making you believe that you've been there recently enough to understand that carrying sadness through to the other side can be a gift. Jemison's great trick is invoking the communal over the specific. In Boy Problems, her distress is hers, but it's also yours. It's also everyone's. Boy Problems are a stand-in for an entire menu of anguish. In 2021, the sad banger became richer, not only in its range of sound, but also in its range of concerns. In the late spring and early summer, the post-vaccination, pre-Delta haze of uncertainty and optimism, there were two equally thrilling songs that suited the times. First, in May, the singer Zoe Weiss released the EP Golden Wings, which contained the song Girls Like Us, a delightful lament, turning over thoughts about trust, not wanting to get hurt, isolation. It's an anthem aimed at young women, but a far resonating tune. It builds slowly, effectively, beginning with sparse instrumentation, growing gently toward a flourish as the chorus hits, and then the song's breathlessly spiraling percussion grows louder before the sonic bottom falls out, stripping itself down to a few simple piano chords for a brief spell before sprinting to the finish line. The sad banger isn't always about relentless tempo. It can also offer an opportunity to play with a kind of musical modulation that mirrors tentative pleasure in the face of anxiety. In early June, the artist Pronoun released the EP OMG I Made It, and the penultimate song, Half of the Time, has the kind of early summer brightness that recalls biting directly into a citrus fruit, with no regard for how the juice might stain your shirt. It's an energizing introduction that, much like Springsteen's Hungry Heart, challenges the musical excitement in the first line. So here we are again, same as it ever was, cracking a smile while admitting defeat. Half of the Time is less of an outright sad song and more of a shrug of a song, winding through depths of apathy and contentment in the same verse. The lyrics sometimes run together as rapid sentences, language tumbling from the sky and twisting to fit into lines right at the last minute, like Tetris pieces. It is best summed up by the refrain that gets rung out at the end, with Pronoun repeatedly singing, "Half of the time I'm feeling fine," leaving a listener to wonder if just half is enough. There might be a sadness in that pondering, but the song itself felt too good, and still feels too good, to leave me with anything but an affirmative response. Lil Nas X's Lost in the Citadel offered up the always ideal sad banger narrative of an unrequited, one-sided relationship. Even if I am not in the throes of unbearable longing, these kinds of songs can convince me not only that I am in love, but also that the person I love will not love me back. In an adjacent universe to this one, Mitski returned with another of her periodic odes to crumbling love with The Only Heartbreaker, an absolute storm of ecstatic synth-pop underneath lyrics of resignation and resentment. In a slightly sparser offering, James Blake and Z came together for an atmosphere coming back, which has an added benefit of the kind of tug-of-war that exists between two people, outlining a similar ache, trying to build a bridge toward each other. Unrequited love rarely fails as a subject for songs, because that type of emotion, reaching for someone else who will not or cannot reach back, is an act of sometimes fevered imagination. If the desired party is not present to answer for how you have built them up in your mind, the emotional landscape becomes much more expansive, not tied to the guide rails of reality. These songs wormed their way into my rotations with the most consistency in 2021. Of all of them, I find myself returning to Pronoun's tune the most, probably because of how its chorus builds to a point where yelling the words out seems like the only reasonable reaction, even though that vocal catharsis often leaves me with nothing beyond a fluorescent burst, a collision of palpable but hardly recognizable emotions, and then a fading echo. Nothing is better, but certainly nothing is worse. This kind of surrender has been a comfort for me in recent years, in these uniquely anxiety-inducing times. Most of the things I am angry or heartbroken about are raging beyond my control, and so I need the small containers to put those feelings in, while still giving in to the occasional joyful impulse. A clean floor, not to dance as a way to shake off my burdens, but to find some strange harmony with them, amid the sometimes joy, sometimes misery of living. Everything Is and Remains, and then another song starts. The next article is entitled, Mitski is More Than TikTok. Why Does Gen Z Love the Pain in the Singer's Music by Lindsay Zolads. At the end of the summer of 2019, the indie musician Mitski was on top of the world and she was exhausted. Mitski, whose last name is Miyawaki, though she doesn't use it professionally, was wrapping up a long, triumphant tour for her acclaimed 2018 album, Be the Cowboy. The music website Pitchfork had named it Album of the Year. NPR proclaimed Mitski the 21st century's Poet Laureate of Young Adulthood. Iggy Pop on his BBC radio show called her the most advanced American songwriter that I know. She was about to turn 29 and had finally reached the perch of success and stability that she had been working toward for years, but she also felt disillusioned. Everyone wanted a piece of her. 90% of her time was spent on administrative tasks and promotional duties instead of writing and performing, the part of the job she truly loved. She hadn't been home in years. She wasn't even sure where or what home was anymore. So that June, on her charmingly candid personal Twitter account, she announced that an upcoming date headlining Central Park Summer Stage would be her last show indefinitely. Fans protested so vociferously that she issued a clarification. Y'all, I'm not quitting music, she tweeted to her 130,000 followers. I've been on nonstop tour for over 5 years. I haven't had a place to live during this time, and I sense that if I don't step away soon, my self-worth identity will start depending too much on staying in the game in the constant churn. The next week, she performed the ultimate digital mic drop. She deleted her account. Mitski moved to Nashville. She's not quite sure why, because she really doesn't know anyone there, but she liked how specifically weird it was. A town with stories. A local businessman had recently died and left his substantial estate to his border collie. Bachelorette parties were a surreal and ever-present cottage industry. There's always a woman crying on the street and 5 other women in matching t-shirts comforting her, as Mitski put it to me. It feels like such a good place to observe the human condition. Maybe she would never make a record of her own again. Maybe that was okay. She would live quietly and relatively cheaply, she thought, writing songs for other artists, perhaps in anonymity and blissful ignorance of what people were saying about her on the internet. When she was touring, her writing process became hurried. A few piecemeal lines or melodic ideas jotted down in snatched moments of downtime. But in Nashville, and eventually in the imposed stillness of the pandemic, she found that she could finally spend entire days writing. She likened the process to visiting a Korean spa. I got to go into the metaphorical sauna and sit there a while and feel it and relax. One of the first new songs she wrote was an introspective number called Working for the Knife, which put words and droning chords to her experience of creative burnout. I used to think I'd be done by 20, it goes. Now at 29, the road ahead appears the same, though maybe at 30, I'll see a way to change. The songs kept coming. Eventually, she accumulated enough of them that she realized, hallelujah, goddammit, that she was making another album. She called it Laurel Hell, a nickname given to the dense and thorny, but deceptively beautiful thickets of poisonous shrubs that proliferate in southern Appalachia. Like those flowers' siren songs, the record contains some of the most immediately accessible music of Mitski's career, and some of the most tonally and thematically challenging. Sleek, danceable, 80s pop-inspired tunes coexist with songs like The Eerie Heat Lightning, which conjures the stirring drone-like sensibility that John Cale brought to the Velvet Underground. Mitski insisted that the first single be not a catchy pop song like The Only Heartbreaker, but the finished version of Working for the Knife, with its industrial-tinged synthesizer chords that clank like factory equipment. That might not necessarily seem enticing, but Laurel Hell has been Mitski's most commercially successful album yet. When it was released in early February, it debuted at number 5 on the Billboard album charts, above recent releases by Drake, Adele, and The Weeknd, and it was that week's best-selling album in America. A lot of that has to do with a strange thing that has happened in the 3 years since Mitski's retreat from the spotlight. She has become, for reasons that she does not entirely understand, huge on TikTok. As of this writing, Mitski's music has provided a soundtrack for more than 2.5 million user-generated videos on the platform, and TikToks with the tag Mitski have been viewed 1.5 billion times. The hashtag Mitski Therapy, referring to her emotionally evocative lyrics, has close to 50 million views. Mitski Talk is its own unofficial corner of the app, where thousands of users fawn over snippets of her interviews and videos of her live performances, and occasionally post lovingly crafted parodies of her songs, several of which have gone viral themselves. Mitski's music grants people whom society often treats as marginal the screaming vividness of main characters, and this is a huge part of its appeal. Give me your tired, your awkward, your lonesome masses, a Mitski song seems to say, and I will let them feel all the feelings. I don't get it, but it's nice, said Mitski, who is now 31, referring to TikTok with a laugh. I only know what I've been told. All of the business people are like, this is so great. And I'm like, please stop texting me these TikToks. It's like a lot of things I've just decided not to think about. Whether she wants to think about it or not, though, this influx of new fans meant that she would be playing larger venues than ever, including headlining Radio City Music Hall on March 24th. For all her ambivalence about the grind of touring, Mitski realized during the pandemic that she missed performing, that pointed sense of meaning that comes when every moment of every day is leading up to this pinnacle that is the show. It would take much physical and mental preparation to get her back into that rhythm, and when I visited her in Los Angeles, she was in the middle of several busy weeks of rehearsals. One afternoon in late January, Mitski and the choreographer Jazz Lynn stood in front of a mirrored wall in a cavernous dance space called Stomping Ground, L.A., running through the show's meticulously planned moves. Stay Soft, an upbeat but haunting new single, blared overhead. Here it's like you're one of those plants that, when an animal approaches, you close up, Lynn instructed. Mitski is far from a trained dancer. She took a few ballet lessons in first grade and then quit because a kid who bullied her at school was in the class and the bully's mom was the teacher. No offense to them now because I'm sure they're very nice people. Still, when she was planning the tour for Be the Cowboy in 2018, Mitski decided she wanted to do something different on stage from thrashing away at her guitar. She reached out to the artist and choreographer Monica Mirabel, and together they choreographed an entire tour in a whirlwind 3 weeks. The palpable rawness of Mitski's onstage movement has only further endeared her to her fans. The fact that she's not a trained dancer, Mirabel told me, gives permission for other bodies to move. But at Stomping Ground, it was also making Mitski a bit nervous. We're going to do the scary thing now, Lynn said toward the end of their three-hour rehearsal, spinning Mitski around by the shoulders and face this way. Mitski, who had grown accustomed to watching herself in the mirrors, groaned. But like the flick of a switch, the exacting discipline she brings to all aspects of her work suddenly kicked in, and she calmed herself with a deep breath. The opening bass notes of Stay Soft boomed from the speakers, and on the offbeat she pretended she was peeking through an invisible curtain, greeting an imagined, feverishly expectant audience. Welcome to someone else's home, Mitski greeted me the next morning at her rental house on a quiet street in nearby Monterey Park. She brewed us each a cup of tea in the kitchen, and then we settled at a picnic table in the endemic flora-filled backyard. I asked her, barefaced and wrapped in a hunter green fleece sweatshirt, if Nashville now felt like home. She seemed both surprised and delighted when she said yes. I miss it now. Isn't that nice? Home has always been an elusive concept for Mitski, who moved frequently as a child because of her father's job in the U.S. Senate Department. She was born in Japan, but spent time in Turkey, China, and Malaysia. Though an American citizen, Mitski did not live for an extended period in the United States, until she was in high school. She was forever the new kid, trying on a different personality in every school, afraid to make deep social ties that she knew she would inevitably have to break. When she began writing music in her late teens, though, she found a creative outlet for those pangs of outsiderdom. Across her first several albums, she discovered that time-worn songwriter's paradox. The more fearlessly she confessed her loneliness, the more people connected to her music. Take Your Best American Girl, the breakout single from her 2016 album, Puberty 2. The song deftly captures the anxiety and isolation of an intercultural relationship. You're an all-American boy, Mitski howls atop scorched earth guitar chords. I guess I couldn't help trying to be your best American girl. Trying implies a failure. But the song is also animated by the knowledge that the words best, American, and even girl are all stifling fictions, and that anyone claiming to fit those roles perfectly all the time is probably lying. The song's pulverizing volume glorifies such angst into something epic. It's melancholic, but also stirringly triumphant. A few years ago, during one of those strange liminal moments of tour-related travel, Mitski found herself spending Christmas alone in a Malaysian hotel room. She was so lonely that she found herself opening up the window just to listen to strangers talking to one another outside. As she had so many times before, she coped with the feeling by channeling it into a song, which would become Nobody, a disco-inflected single from Be the Cowboy. I know no one will save me, I just need someone to kiss, she crooned to a mute, unreciprocating nothingness. Give me one good, honest kiss and I'll be all right. Like many of the best Mitski songs, Nobody luxuriates in an abject feeling until it becomes something celebratory, glorious, almost transcendent. 3 years ago, after it was released as a moderately popular single, this yearning boomeranged back to her in the most unexpected way when it became, of all things, the soundtrack to a meme, the de facto soundtrack for thousands of videos by TikTok users, miming an escape from their fears or unpleasant experiences, while Mitski sings the word nobody with an escalating passion. One video was captioned, when the closer called out and you see your manager walking toward you. Another, when you've been begging for a boyfriend and the boy actually tries to talk to you. It was random, yes, but also cathartic. Who among us did not fantasize about running away from our everyday boogeymen as though we were the last surviving character in a slasher flick? Not everyone who made a Nobody video became a Mitski diehard. But it certainly led some younger fans to discover her earlier albums, where they were delighted to find even raw expressions of young adult angst. One old song of hers that has become unexpectedly popular online, Class of 2013, from an album she released in college, features primal yells and anxiety about growing up. Mom, am I still young? Can I dream for a few months more? A quick flick through Mitski Talk shows it to be a place where many young people have come to express, share, and in some cases exaggeratedly anesthetize feelings for which they may not have other outlets. Mitski's only theory about her social media stardom is half-joking but a bit morbid. Once someone is dead, they become this hero, she said, and I'm dead on the internet, so they make me out to be a hero. It's not much of an exaggeration. Among many Mitski fan accounts in the Twitter feed, Mitski's archive, which reposts screenshots from her deleted account to be pored over like the cone of an ancient philosopher. This article also continues, but we're out of time, so we'll have to stop here. That's it for this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I've been reading from the March 13th issue. I'm Carla Pariser. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to Chris.